Right, so this is a big novel, and there's lots to say, so I'm going to just approach it from a couple of different angles, and I hope that they'll leave lots of things for us to talk about in seminar. I probably won't even finish the notes that I've got here. I want to start just by with a section called Literary Genealogies. And start with the relationship between Adichie and Chinua Achebe. Specifically to focus on just one aspect of this relationship. There's a lot that could be said. Achebe is born 1930, died just last year, and was regarded by many as the as a sort of founding figure of the post-colonial African and specifically Nigerian novel. In fact, not only a novelist, also a children's stories writer, a poet, wrote some tremendously important essays, one of which you may have read elsewhere, a really interesting essay accusing Conrad of racism in Heart of Darkness, which was published in the early 70s and got a lot of publicity then. Adichie has a particular affinity to Achebe's work. She works through his work very systematically in her own, and I think that he's one of the more important figures. I want to focus here on just, this is Susan Andrade's comment, but it's a specific aspect. It's to do with the convention that Adichie is using here of a sense of a book within a book convention. Achebe's first novel, Things Fall Apart, is a tragedy. It tells the story of a man named Okonkwo who lives in an Igbo village at the dawn of the colonial period. It's a tragedy for a variety of reasons, but one of them leading to the fact that Okonkwo, who is a man of substance, has won many titles, but is progressively undermined, or his social power, in a sense, is reduced. He's put into difficult situations until at the end of the novel, he hangs himself, which is an extraordinary thing to do, unprecedented, deeply humiliating and shameful, and so on. The novel, it's a short novel, about 120, 130 pages. What we see in the novel is white people on the very margins. They have very little actual presence in the novel. But right at the end of the novel, the white district officer appears, and this is more or less the only passage in the novel which is focalized through this white colonial figure. And so we see him trying to understand the meaning of Okonkwo's death, spectacularly failing to do so. What we see are the colonialist and racist assumptions and so on. But we see him in some ways taking ownership of this area of Nigeria, Igbo land. The passage that I want to look at in a minute focuses on this particular moment. Here, Andrade is writing about the simultaneity of Adichie's writing, but she may be the first Nigerian author to have comparable fame, with the one difference, I think. There's a real sense, isn't there, in which Adichie is a genuine celebrity. In a way that Achebe was not, partly because social media and so on didn't exist in Achebe's time, we didn't make use of it. The reader's surprise, I'm sorry if this is I should have issued a spoiler alert, there's no way of doing this lecture without the spoiler, but that of Uwu's authorship of the fiction had parallels a shift of perspective at the end of Things Fall Apart. This is that passage that I was referring to. You see the commissioner doing the thinking here, And he says, the story of this man, we've just read 130 pages of the story of this man. We've got inside Okonkwo's mind, we have understood his village. We've been put, and what's so striking is the distancing that happens here, where the district commissioner says, well, maybe he'll write a whole chapter on this man. Then he actually revises it, because, of course, who is Okonkwo? He's only a native, he's not significant. Maybe I'll write a paragraph. So what we have is this whole 130 pages, this complicated, tragic history that we've read, reduced in the colonial narrative to maybe a paragraph, which, of course, that paragraph will already spectacularly misunderstand Okonkwo. There was so much else to include, one must be firm in cutting out details. He already chosen the title of the book after much thought. And of course, the title of the book is deadly, The Pacification of the Primitive Tribes of the Lower Niger. And that's how the book ends. So it's a very much a shocking kind of ending here. If we move to our book, we see Uwu talking to Richard at the end. Richard has been writing a book throughout the novel, but he asks about Uwu's book at the end. He stopped, because of all the things that have happened, Richard has stopped writing. And Uwu responds to him and says, yes, sir, it will be part of a big book. It will take me many more years to finish it, and I'll call it Narratives of the Life of a Country, he says. Very ambitious, Mr. Richard said. I wish I had that Frederick Douglass book. Here we see Adichie entering into a relationship with American culture, American black literature. The reference here, if you look at the Narratives of a Life of a Country, reference here to Frederick Douglass's famous book, 19th Century Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. But then it's worth, isn't it, spending some time talking about the apparent differences. Narrative of the Life of a Country, on the one hand, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. In Douglass's case, you have the single individual named, and then you have the condition, as it were, what's been left out of history to that point, the idea of the history of American slavery. So this, the story of my life, Frederick Douglass's, ends up being much bigger than me. It ends up including, in fact, an indictment of the whole system of racial slavery, etc., etc. And yet, Uwu is going to make that larger still. Narrative of the Life of a Country. Of course, it's a country that is or was, but was for a very short period of time. So it's a country that gets aborted, cut off by history. But nevertheless, there's the sense, in both cases, there is the movement from the personal to the larger than personal, the collective. In the case of what Uwu has in mind is a country, between the relationship between me and colonial Igbo land, here Biafra. In the case of Douglass, of course, he doesn't raise the question of country so much. American is identifies a country in a sense, but actually it's the question of slavery that's preeminent for him. A subsequent exchange, just about a page later, Uwu gave him the family's name and address. He wants to find out what has happened to this woman that he fancies at the end of the novel. Richard wrote it down afterwards. They're both silent, and Uwu fumbled awkwardly for something to say. Are you still writing your book, sir? No. The World Was Silent When We Died. It's a good title. This is the title that Richard had been writing his book on. He says, yes, it's something that it came from something Colonel Madu said once. Richard paused. The war isn't my story to tell, really. Uwu nodded. He had never thought that it was. The sense of the question is asked here who should write the history of Biafra. What's involved in writing a history or a story or some kind of tale of Biafra? It's obvious that Richard shouldn't be the person to write that. But this opens a set of I think complicated internal questions about the book, because we see here that this title comes from Colonel Mardu. Richard begins to write about it. It's Richard presumably is writing some things about it. What's Uwu's relationship to Richard's writing? When we read the extracts in the novel that say that are titled at the bottom, "The world was silent when we died," that's presumably from Uwu's novel. But has Uwu already read Richard's novel? Is there a sense in which what's happening here is a way taking back what was already taken away when the district commissioner framed a Okonkwo story in Things Fall Apart? Here a white figure, no longer the figure of the district commissioner. On the contrary, Richard is a good man, it would seem, a committed Biafran at least. He speaks fluent Igbo. He is authentically in love with Kainene, so much so that his life is devastated at the end of the novel when she goes missing. This sense of he's a far removed from the district commissioner, and yet he is nevertheless, no matter how sympathetic he might be, this isn't his story to tell. That needs to be reclaimed in some way from Britain, from England, no matter what face England is presenting at this moment. But then also think about the question of the relationship between the novel, "The World Was Silent When We Died," which Richard may have been taking notes towards, which Uwu actually writes, and which then Adichie overwrites, as it were. Whose novel are we reading? What is the relationship between Half of a Yellow Sun, the novel, and "The World Was Silent When We Died"? Whose voice is this? Why does it matter whose voice it is? I think this is very complicated. Right until the very last sentence of the book, in fact, we're not sure whose book we're reading. So the question of what is the relationship between historiography, between the recovery, the memory of a traumatic past, if you like, and who is writing, who is reading, and so on. I think these things are very complicated in this work. So whose story? At one level, of course, this is Biafra's story. This is the Biafran flag for the 3 short years that the state was in. I mean, Half of a Yellow Sun, as you see, comes from this. So are we to understand the book as an act in some ways of a kind of a submerged national historiography? Is this a nationalist history? Is it a pro-Biafran account? Why is it necessary for Adichie, a contemporary Nigerian author, to write this story about the history set in the context of Biafra in these few short years? I mean, you could argue, of course, that, I mean, the obvious things, that the story has not been told properly, or it's not been told sufficiently, and so on, although we'll see that it has been told quite often. But there's something that she feels that she needs to do in writing it. It's interesting that a few years after Adichie's book had appeared, Achebe published a book that he had waited 40 years to publish. Achebe became quite active on the part on the Biafran cause during the Biafran, the Nigerian Civil War, the Biafra War, whatever term you use to describe that. He became a spokesperson for Biafran emancipation, for Biafran statehood, as did many of the young, at that point, 30 years old, 35 year old, and so on, writers, intellectuals, activists, and so on, based in Nsukka University, just north of Enugu, in Iboland, which is where, of course, Odinibo and Olana are based in the novel. The character of Okeoma in the novel is based on probably the best known of all Nigerian poets of this time, who died tragically in the Civil War. But here, Achebe spends all this time writing, and I'm struck by the title of his book, "There Was a Country." I mean, it's there's a kind of nostalgia to it. There's something in this book, and the subtitle, A Personal History of Biafra. Again, we have those two elements, the personal and the country put together. That's what seems always to come up in these cases, a personal history of Biafra. Not my experiences within Biafra, which would be another thing altogether, wouldn't it? But a personal history of Biafra. Let me just show you a few maps so we can put things on the map. We can position things. This is obviously the standard Mercator image of Africa. You'll see Nigeria. I mean, all of you know Nigeria here. And so Nigeria surrounded by Francophone African territories. There's Ghana, kind of three states over, the Gold Coast as it was, which was also a British colony. But by and large, ringed round, I mean, parts of northern Cameroon were also British, but the most of West Africa was Francophone, French colonial, and all the way from Côte d'Ivoire to Senegal, down through Gabon and Cameroon. And we see in the novel the sense in which, both in the colonial period and after, there is a jockeying for power among the imperial states involved in the constitution of Nigeria, in setting Nigeria up as a colony. Nigeria North, Nigeria South. What we understand very clearly is that Nigeria doesn't have a pre-colonial history as Nigeria. It has a very long history, lettered, written about, and so on and so forth, as various kinds of states, empires, kingdoms, etc., etc. But the British are the ones who yoke it together into a colony, which then becomes a state, and which is nevertheless divided across all sorts of lines. It has no history of itself as a working polity. It wasn't a polity of that kind. Igbo land is Republican, etc. Yoruba is a polytheistic state with kings of various kinds. Up in the north, the Hausa Fulani people have been Muslim for 1,000 years, and with very large kind of territories involved in the north. Very different landscapes. As Olana is going up from south to north, she reflects on the difference. I mean, down on the south, obviously, we have tropical jungles, dense forests, etc., etc. Up in the north, it's just south of the Sahara Desert, so it's sandy, dry, a different climate, etc., etc. These are the states of Nigeria, 67 to 76. So, in other words, the period that we're talking about here, 1967, is when Biafra secedes. Biafra is the three southeastern states, Cross River, East Central State Rivers, are the three that break away to form Biafra. It's effectively what was known as Igbo land by the British colonials. But we know that Olana travels way up, doesn't she, to north when she goes to visit Muhammad, travels up to Kano in the north. We see Lagos way over there in the west, which is where Alana's family lives. Rivers, or we'll look on the next map, Rivers is where Port Harcourt is, and so on. This is a more contemporary map. At the center of the contemporary map, you see Abuja, which is where, quite recently, after the Civil War, they decided to put the federal capital of Nigeria, following policies, say, in Brazil, where, as you know, Brasilia was constructed to be the capital of Brazil, not Rio, and so on and so forth. In Australia, too, because of the competition between Melbourne and Sydney, Canberra was set up as somewhere between those two, was set up as the capital of the country. Here, Abuja, right in the middle of the country, showing an ostensible state neutrality between the various. But you can see, I think if you look at down in the south, You can see, I think, can we see Nsukka on that map? No, just you can see Enugu though, and Nsukka is just north of Enugu, up there. If you look at the linguistic groups, you see down in the bottom the sort of the tan yellow is Igbo speaking. To the east, Ekoi, etc. So, but so many of the people who are not Igbo speaking, but that not as their primary language, but are could speak Igbo fluently and were in some sense drawn into Igbo culture and Igbo statehood, also broke away to become part of Biafra. But we see Hausa Fulani up in the north and Yoruba over there, specifically on the west, the largest concentrations. This is the map of Nigeria with Biafra showing. Of course, current maps don't show Biafra because Biafra no longer exists. But that so here a closer picture. Enugu then clearly enough marked, and as I say, Nsukka slightly north of that. But we can see Port Harcourt clearly enough on that map. This is a long quotation, but I thought worth reading to just give you a sense of what was involved in the Biafran War, the Nigerian Civil War, how one wants to describe it. Let me give you just a second to read over that. I mean, some of it is merely kind of political, as it were. But the main events sort of focus on the tremendous violence that was involved. Two points to highlight there, especially during the Civil War, an estimated 3,000 to 5,000 people died daily in Biafra from starvation. It's an extraordinary number, and the pictures, of course, that came out of that were horrific. I think a standard kind of image that appeared all over the media at that point. Here, children, of course, malnourished, starving, destitute, and so on. The second factor was just this the sense of the Nigerian Navy establishing a sea blockade that denied food, medical supplies, and weapons, again impacting Biafran soldiers and civilians alike. That particular passage has strikes me with a kind of renewed ferocity today, because of course we're confronting just the same thing, aren't we? In the case of Saudi Arabia's blockading of the ports of the port city at Aden in Yemen. So with the threat of a famine greater even than the famine in Biafra. So the sense of this particular horror is being visited around the world right now again. Again, with massive involvement, of course, from the global superpowers. This peculiar sense in which internal developments are in some horrible way overdetermined or shaped by events elsewhere. But it was just that you know, I was watching a program on, I think it was Panorama the other night again, but for the last two or three years, as one's been reading about the blockade in Yemen, the same thing has happened. Why would one regime actually cut off all possibility of food to a people that it's coming, particularly in the Nigerian case, where we were talking about an attempt to actually insist that Biafra didn't secede but remained part of Nigeria. The goal was unification, but unification at what expense? It would seem as though, you know, whether or not all people in Igbo land died was of no consequence, or it didn't matter. That would be a price worth paying, etc. I wanted to look very briefly at some other texts too. Adichie herself refers to both of these authors. Ike and Nwapa, a woman writer from Achebe's cohort, perhaps the best known woman writer from Nigeria of that period. Her text, Never Again, Sunset at Dawn, which is Ike's novel of Biafra. This is merely to give you a sense of the tremendous amount of writing there was or has been since 1970 dealing with the war. I mean, just to sketch through a couple of... You'll notice that most of these texts, and probably for understandable reasons, are written by Igbo authors rather than, say, Yoruba or Hausa Fulani or some other... both Eri Airo, Esso Mezu, both... Igbo. Here we have Elechi Amadi. Ken Saro-Wiwa, interestingly, Soza Boy, which is the pidgin for soldier, soja. Saro-Wiwa, as probably some of you know at least, was executed by the Nigerian state in, when was that, 95, 90, something like that, because of his political activism around oil extraction. In the part of Nigeria, he's not, in fact, an Igbo speaker, but the Ogoni people who are adjacent to the Igbo, and he was very active in arguing that Ogoni land was being destroyed by oil extraction. Of course, this didn't sit well with Shell, and it didn't sit well with the Nigerian federal government, and he was sentenced to death. And despite the protestations of people all over the world, that sentence was carried out. But he was a very well-known novelist. His son, in fact, Ken Saro-Wiwa, is a well-known journalist in the UK at the moment. You may have seen some of his work. Ken Jr. INC Aniebo, Cyprian Akwenzi, a Yoruba writer who writes racy kind of popular style work, but this is one other collection. Isidore Opewo, Buchi Emejita, perhaps the best known female author from Nigeria prior to Adichie, moved to Britain quite early, wrote some very important, African diasporic works, or we'll describe those as In the Ditch, Second Class Citizen, but felt the need also to return to write a war novel. What's interesting about these is that they're all war novels, so there's a real need to come to terms with this absolutely cataclysmic event for people, I would say, born, let's say, between 1930 and 1950. The Biafran War is the shaping event of their lives in some way. Unless you can understand that, then it becomes even more interesting that Adichie, who of course is born afterwards, should be the one to take this up. You don't find that in other writers of her generation. Nigeria is a country where we tend to refer very specifically to the generations of writers. First generation Achebe, second generation somebody like Ben Okri, third generation Teju Cole and Adichie. Very much people are counting the generations in a way that they don't do elsewhere on the continent. Okay, so let me say something then about, having looked then at the sense of the literary genealogies, I mean, I haven't mentioned, obviously, the Mayor of Casterbridge and the other kinds of works that are involved in the text. It is a very literary book in that sense. Think about the plotting, if you like. I want to go back to that quotation from Nadine Gordimer that I began last week with, because it seemed to me that it was very relevant to Adichie. If you want to know the facts of the retreat from Moscow, you may read a history book. If you want to know what war is like and how people of a certain time and background dealt with it as their personal situation, you must read War and Peace. And then I've tried to transpose that onto if you want to know the same sorts of things here. So it's what war is like and how people of a certain time and background dealt with it as their personal situation. This is a novel about of things falling apart in some sense, but it's also a novel of things not falling apart. Part of the interest in the novel is how the people live in some ways through this horrific experience. The novel shuttles between the early 1960s. Independence has just been won in Nigeria, 1960. And the late 1960s, which is after the coup, after the counter-coup, and then at the end of this war. But then it's written, obviously, only in the early noughties. So it's written over that gap of 40 years. It makes you wonder, internally to the novel, diegetically within the novel, when was Uwu's novel written? When is the world was silent when we died written? And he says to Richard, it's going to take me many years to write it. Does he mean 10, 20, 30? What is the relationship between this book and that book in some way? Is something else being added by Adichie here? It's 40 years, or 30, nearly 40 years, 65, 2006, that period of time. So that sense of what has been, what lessons have been learned, and what has not been learned, what has been forgotten, what needs to be retrieved in some ways across that gap of you. When you say it needs to be retrieved, you mean that it's been unmastered in some sense. It's not been come to terms with. It still lies there as a kind of wound, which needs to be treated. And I think this is a war novel, but it's also in some ways a memory, a trauma novel, in that sense. So recuperation, remembrance. There's a terrible quotation early on when Lieutenant Colonel Gowon comes to power at the end of the novel, is put in place by the federal Nigerian state with the backing of the British as well, and is put in place over the whole of Nigeria. And his first speech afterwards declares, it's quoted in the novel, he says, this is the end of a brutal process in which there are neither victors nor vanquished. He says, and of course we are feeling this from the standpoint of Alana, who's listening to these words, and she is, how cynical in a way, how empty, but how appallingly arrogant are those words. Neither, it's so easy for him to say that, and so on. She at the time is just looking at the ruins of the Nigerian fleet anchored just off Port Harcourt. This is the federal Nigerian government. The fleet had been destroyed by the Biafran forces during the war. And she reflects on this, and she says, they won, but we did this, she said, and realized how odd it felt to say they won, to voice a defeat she did not believe. Hers was not a feeling of having been defeated. It was one of having been cheated. The sense of the Biafran project aborted, destroyed, and so on. And for Alana, the inability of coming to terms with it. Just as a small note on Yakubu Gowon, as some of you may know, he after he was deposed himself in 74, 75, he fled to the UK, where he still lives. And he came to Warwick to get his PhD in history. So we have our own involvement in this ghastly story. The puppet who was put into place after the war is a Warwick Garrett graduate. Should we feel pleased? I don't know. What should we have done? Said, no, you can't come. So here the sense of no victors and no vanquished, and we have Alana's thoughts about it. But then also we have this exchange soon afterwards in the novel, where they're driving up from Port Harcourt, I think, up to Nsukka, to find what's left of their homes, if anything is left there. And the car is pulled over by government troops, by federal Nigerian troops. And the casual detail there behind him, one of his boys was shouting, a dead male body lay in the bush. Just as a casual detail, the sense of, we are made very aware, aren't we, here in the novel, of the body count, in some sense. So the body's just lying casually strewn, starved, shot, etc. And Nsukka, the officer, straightened up and laughed. Ah, Nsukka University, you are the ones who planned the rebellion with Ojukwu, you book people. Odenibo said nothing, looked straight ahead. The officer yanked his door open. Let's see how you can help a united Nigeria. When he climbed out, the officer slapped his face so violently, so unexpectedly, that Odenibo fell against the car. Baby was crying. You are not grateful we didn't kill all of you. come on, carry those wood planks quickly, two at a time. This is the inside the novel. We've had Alana's reaction, but we also are thinking through that thing of no victors, no vanquished. It reads very much as though there are victors and vanquished here in this context. So, if we're talking about plotting in the novel, it's besides the fact, besides these temporal dimensions and the internal, the relationship between the diegetic book and the one that we're actually reading, inside the book, outside the book, which book, there is the question of the two forms of the novel. It's a war novel, but it's also a domestic drama. And those two themes, I mean, those are two sub-generic forms, if you like. There are genres for them. And Adichie is putting them together in a really interesting way here. Of course, the domestic novel is usually female-centered. The war novel is usually not. One of the things, obviously, that she's doing, as Buchi Amechita was doing before her, is to write a war novel from a woman's point of view. But I think more than that is going on. I'm struck by the fact that as we're reading, and we start then with these things, and we spend 100 pages getting to know the characters very well, to see them. She's very, very interested in writing whole characters, as it were, not in producing stereotypes in some sense. You could argue that Chebe's district commissioner is a stereotype. He's what a district colonial officer would be like. Achebe's not interested in him. He's only interested in making the point. She is interested in Richard. There are characters where a certain kind of one-sidedness, or I don't mean one-sidedness, I mean a certain tendentiousness is there. In the portrait, for instance, of Odenibo's mother, an unpleasant woman. Certainly in the portrait of Susan, Richard's lover, who is a bigoted, racist, colonialist type. I mean, there, Adichie's sympathies are not engaged with these characters. But the major characters of the novel, her sympathies are engaged. Richard, Uwu, Odenibo to a certain extent, certainly Olana and Kainene. These characters are given a fairly rich interior life, all of them. And we spend 100 pages seeing those lives come into a relationship before anything else has happened. In fact, the life they live, by and large, is the life of Riley. Odenibo plays tennis, he lectures to students, he's in a new university, he feels himself to be part of an emerging project, the new Nigeria, in before there is a Biafra. It's a fabulous life, totally privileged. Olana comes from massive privilege, and she defines herself in this position. Kainene is a wealthy woman, etc. Even Uwu, although he's at a much lower level, but we're constantly seeing that for him, how luxuriant these surroundings seem, how this enables him to kind of lord it over his sister when he goes back home and so on. So it is a privilege. It's a little sort of idyll before the storm. In some sense. Two things can be said then. The first one is that we know the storm is coming, partly because from a certain point we get this, the world was silent when we died. But also that when the storm comes, we know what will happen in the war novel narrative, because we know what happens in the real world around Biafra. We know that 67 to 70 is a time of brutal defeats, devastating losses, mass killings, and huge destruction. What we don't know is what's going to happen to the protagonists in that event. So the way in which the two stories come closer and closer together, and it's an odd feeling. We know how the one drama is going to play out. We immediately worry that some of the characters are going to die in this, when Olana goes up to Kano, for instance, and has to come back with the woman with the calabash next to her, etc. We're fearful for her life also there. But the two generic types of the work come together in some strange way. I'm interested though in the fact that the characters are given enough detail for us to see that a certain kind of dramatic development could happen between them, even without the war. If you think just about Odenebo, for instance, and Olana, I mean, this is my take on them. Odenebo is portrayed to us as a fairly squat. He's a solid man, and that solidity registers his way. He's secure. I don't think that he's arrogant, and I don't think that he's complacent. I mean, you can tell me what you think later. But he's very sure of himself. One of the first things we see about him is how he calls out a man who's in a queue in front, where a white man is pushed to the queue in front of him, and he goes and grabs him, and he pushes him back to the beginning. That's almost the first thing we see about Odenebo. So this is a person who knows himself, knows his relative powers, knows his articulacy. There's a confidence. I mean, it's that confidence in some ways that draws Olana to him, in some ways. But it borders on a kind of a certain kind of complacency. In some ways. I'm wondering if he, in some ways he's rather like the figure of the lawyer that we saw in Nadine Gordimer's novel. But set that aside for the moment. Nevertheless, we see in Odenebo that kind of, because he knows that he's able to represent himself so well, he doesn't fear that anyone else will speak for him. He knows he can speak for himself. He can say what he needs to say. He can get what he needs to get, etc. He's wealthy enough. He's articulate enough. He's powerful enough. You know, he has a presence. And that, of course, shades into a certain sort of insensitivity towards the fact that for other people it's not so simple. So I'm thinking particularly of the exchange between Olana and Odenebo's mother, when the mother comes back and says, you know, you're a witch. And she is unnerved, unmoored is what the novel calls her. And he can only see that as being, why are you getting yourself so rattled by this, he says to Olana. You know, you're being self-indulgent. He doesn't, you know, in other words, because he wouldn't feel it, he could just say, I don't care what my mother says, I want this. She can't do that with that same kind of ease. There's a certain kind of insensitivity towards the vulnerability of others. Which of course sets him up to hurt Olana quite significantly. On the other hand, we have Olana. I mean, she comes from this extraordinarily wealthy family. She has every kind of entitlement. She is extraordinarily beautiful. She's clever. But notice that her beauty, she doesn't experience her beauty as something which strengthens her or reinforces her being in the world in some sense. She experiences on the contrary, she gets exploited through her beauty in some way. Throughout the early parts of the novel, we're told that she thinks that really deep down, she's quite a mediocre thinker. She doesn't think that she's all that brilliant. She thinks in some ways that she may be a bit of a fraud teaching sociology at Nsukka University. She's in awe in some way of Odenebo. What we see, in other words, is a certain kind of, we certainly see vulnerability, fragility, even a certain kind of brittle hollowness in Olana. I'm mentioning this because it seems to me that what we get in this novel, even before the horrible things that happen, we've been given enough to see that this novel can go various ways. In other words, we could see how the domestic novel might play itself out. And of course it does, but the domestic novel then gets joined with the war novel. And that plays itself out in even wider kind of context. And think also of Richard. We see Richard as a kind of, very much as a liberal, somebody who is explicitly anti-racist, although as in Gordimer's novel as well, there's this slight sense occasionally, is it just that he says the wrong thing? On one occasion, he says something, if you remember, which angers the person that he's talking to, where he says, you know, they have great, they had great, you know, great art, and the they is obviously, you know, the Africans in general. He doesn't say natives. He doesn't use any kind of disparaging or racist term, but there's just the hint of the fact that at certain moments he's inclined to do something. Later on in the novel, where right at the end of the novel, where he has a short kind of exchange, a little fight with Madhu, which he loses, he says, you know, I hope you didn't lay a black hand on her. And it's that anger. I mean, the fact that it's the black hand that upsets Madhu particularly. I mean, Madhu would have said something anyway, that he hadn't touched, or he was in love with Kainena, but he didn't do anything. But why does that word black come up there for Richard? Is there something, that despite everything that he is, he's not quite been able to extirpate or get rid of it? It's just this worrying kind of sense, right down at some level there. The full weight of the colonial history hadn't been thought through. Nevertheless, he comes to Nigeria. He's very much committed to the Biafran cause. He's fluent in Igbo. He will move there. He wants to do things. We also see the strange hollowness of his life back in England, the fact that it was not a happy childhood in any way. He has nothing there to protect. He's looking for something, isn't he? He's looking for love, you could say. He's looking for a cause, and so on. So we see in Richard again all of the kinds of things, a little bit of contradictoriness, but again the wheels of narrative are set in motion. I'm saying in the first 100 pages, we see a great deal that helps us to understand how the relationship between Richard and Kainene and the others is going to play out. We see why, in some ways, he's confused by Alana's beauty. It's striking that the novel spends quite a lot of time talking about how beautiful Richard is. People say he's the handsomest person they've seen, or he's tall, he's good looking. But he doesn't carry himself at all like a person who knows that. I mean, so that we're a bit shocked when we read those passages in the novel. Is he? I thought he was kind of nerdy. Etc. But not so. He's graceful. As well as being open-hearted. I mean, he loves the hot pepper soup, etc. I mean, he really. The English colonial phrase is going native, and of course it's meant as a term of disparagement. Why people would say to somebody else who had learned an African, "Oh, you've gone native, have you?" He's gone native, but in a way that isn't colonial in some sense. That is how people might connect. He's found a culture that he admires, respects, wants to live in, and he takes all the steps that he can to find himself there, knowing that he's always going to be somehow on the outside. So we see enough to see in Richard's case how things could play out. Similarly, Uwu and all of the others. We're constantly. I mean, Adichie says of Uwu, for instance, that she tried to paint him as somebody who moves over the course of, because we see him young and then we see him getting older in horrible circumstances, but she tried to portray him as somebody who moves from being purely reactive to being someone who is an agent in his own terms, who takes responsibility for his own actions. We see sometimes that his actions are deplorable, unforgivable, etc. Some of the things that are done. But in the beginning, particularly, we are made to see how this is, because in some sense, it's moving worlds that he goes through. He moves from a small village community to this fantastically Western-centered, but not Eurocentric, if that makes sense to you, the world that they live in. I mean, it's true that Odinibo keeps calling him my good man, and so on and so forth, but Odinibo's relationship to Western culture is not fawning, is it? This is not a kind of colonialist mind. Odinibo's politics are quite complicated. They are Igbo-centered, anti-Nigerian, anti-Pan-African, but anti-colonialist. I mean, this is not a simple thing to pick up. Other characters accuse him of being a tribalist. Oh, you only say things that are pro-Igbo, but that's not what he believes fully. It's a complicated picture. So I think not Eurocentric at all. Uwu comes into this community from the outside. He doesn't understand a thing. I mean, I love it when he goes to the fridge early on. And there is this vast chicken. I mean, and he couldn't even get his head around the idea that they would eat chicken twice a week, never mind a huge chicken. And so inappropriate in some ways are his initial responses. Of course, he grabs the leg and sort of chomps it down as quickly as he can, but then takes the other leg and stuffs it into his pajama pockets as well, because
fearful that, you know, where he comes from, it could go by tomorrow. Food is scarce. Things are not so easy to come by. And he needs to come to terms. How does he begin to be, you know, housekeeper for Oladipo?
Great. I've done two of the themes. That's about time to start. So I was going to focus, let me just tell you the themes that I was going to address. The strange relationship between violence and eroticism in the novel. So much that you could all even speak of an erotics of violence. And I suppose it might be worth mentioning, you know, that term that's sometimes used, which is there such a thing as poverty porn? Particularly when you're reading works from African writers or from Asian writers, is what the Western market wants, is novels that kind of wallow in scenes of destitution and so on and so forth. But then also notice the focalizing throughout the novel, the way in which for Uwu, all women are always represented physically, sexually, from the beginning. I mean, and how that plays itself out. And then also I had a section called States of Damage, which wasn't about the module, but just the peculiar way that this is a damaged state that they're in, but does it function in any way? How does it operate? Okay. And then I was going to play you some Rex Lawson music from The High Life. Rex Lawson being his son, an Igbo musician. It's very 1950s jazzy, but very kind of getting the class register right is difficult. It's very Western, very Saxon, but it's also that it sort of slightly alienates the city in some way. It's not the kind of music you hear once musicians like once Afrobeat emerged and say King, and then never mind somebody like King Sonny Ade, for instance. But I'm thinking also of Fela, Anikulapu Futi, for instance. The Nigerian music has changed fundamentally from the late 70s onwards, but this is an earlier period. You can just look at Rex Lawson, the name kind of gives it away. I mean, for the longest time, you don't know, is this a white person, is it not? The idea of Rex Lawson as an Igbo musician is strange, but anyway, so I'll see you in an hour, or 2 hours, or 3 hours.